From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tom Santapietro returns to the show this week. It's always great to chat with him. In addition to being a sought-after Broadway theater stage manager, Tom Santapietro has written about Doris Day, Barbara Streisand, and Frank Sinatra. He wrote about the Godfather trilogy in his last book, and he has now published The Sound of Music Story. It's a book that celebrates the 50th anniversary of one of the great achievements in cinema by telling in great detail not only about the film, but of the origins of the Broadway show on which the film is based and the true lives of the Von Trapp family, the subjects of The Sound of Music. Tom Santapietro, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much for having me back on.
You know, I love that you managed to mention Doris Day, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, and The Godfather, the subjects of all your previous books, in this book about The Sound of Music. And, of course, you also bring your love and knowledge of the Broadway theater as well.
Well, I think that's perhaps a working definition of the word obsessed. You know, I really, these are people and movies that I care so much about, and, you know, they've all stood the test of time. So when I give talks about these books, I always start it and I look out at the audience and I say, can anybody out there please explain to me why we're paying attention to the Kardashians? And there's usually dead silence in the room.
It is. That's always baffled me. There's always been a Kardashians of some sort that have,
right.
They're famous just because they're famous and they have no talent. They don't add anything to the culture and they're nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, they're this generation's Gabor sisters, you know?
That's right. Of course, yeah. I kind of liked, you know, the Gabor sisters at least were actresses. There was Ava, particularly
right.
On, I liked Green Acres. She was funny on that.
Absolutely, yeah. And they were in some good movies, Moulin Rouge, and
yeah.
But the Kardashians, not so much.
No.
But anyway, and the Kardashians would not be in Sound of Music.
They
so there you go.
They would not. But I wasn't even sure. I'm not sure how you were going to work The Godfather into it, but you did. You managed to work it in. Well, you know, I love Broadway musicals, and I know you do, of course. And I love movies. I love movies. But Broadway musicals are often disappointing when adapted for the screen. I mean, don't you think so?
Oh, yeah. I would say 8 cases out of 10, it's usually pretty much of a disaster. And it's because the good film movie musicals are so rare, it's why we love them all the more. And, you know, The Sound of Music is one that is a really terrific film and had all the right elements in it that, you know, with the right filmmakers, Robert Wise, Ernie Lehman, Ted McCord, you know, these were great, great filmmakers.
Now, Robert Wise had just directed, it wasn't the immediate previous film, but he did do West Side Story. He directed West Side Story as well.
Right. And so when they, you know, I talk in the book about the fact that William Wyler was the original choice for director and had been signed to direct it. And he was clearly the wrong man because he didn't relate to the material. And he said to one of his associates, I don't understand why all of a sudden they burst into song. So that is not a good reason to make a movie musical. And when he, you know, when he dropped out and everybody was secretly relieved, most of all William Wyler, everybody looked to Robert Wise. They thought he was the right man, and of course he was, because he was a great filmmaker, and he was a gentleman, and he set the right tone on that set with 7 kids.
Well, it's interesting that musicals that work in films, I don't know, it's hard to say this, but I mean like Cabaret, for instance, it's vastly different than the Broadway show, because what they did in Cabaret was they cut out every song that was a burst into song, and they only used songs in the movie that were performed on stage.
Right.
So maybe William Wyler was thinking more of that, since these people do perform on stage, but that would shove all of these songs into the last 15 minutes of the picture.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It wouldn't work. And you know, now, of course, we're also ironic and oftentimes cynical that most of the time we'll only buy a musical, just as you say with Cabaret, where there's a reason for the performance. They're backstage, they're on stage, instead of bursting into song. But in The Sound of Music, it works because they were so smart about it. And that's the screenplay and Robert Wise and how he decided to open the film, which I have a whole, that's how I begin the book, because there's so many great stories. But it, you know, you have 10 minutes to make the audience accept it. And after those 10 minutes, they're not going to buy it. But in The Sound of Music, that opening number set up so beautifully, you accept them bursting into song the rest of the movie.
Now, why do you think, since you are so involved with Broadway, why do you think that that hasn't happened on Broadway? People still accept people bursting into song on Broadway without question.
Right. Well, I think it's just the nature of a live live theater. You know, you are sitting in that theater, you know, there's the whole concept of the fourth wall, and you just accept it when you walk into the theater. But when you go to the movies, you expect a certain level of realism, and so when you have people bursting into song and they're 40 feet high on the screen, you're jarred out of that reality. And so, you know, maybe the last great screen musical was Chicago, and that was so smart because Rob Marshall came up with the idea of every number was performed, you know, in Roxy's mind or on a stage, and that's why we bought it. So film versus theater, two different animals.
So let's talk a little bit about the Broadway version of The Sound of Music. What was The Sound of Music like on Broadway?
Well, it was similar to the film, but it was not at all the same thing. There were two songs that were in the stage version that were cut for the film. Richard Rodgers wrote two brand new songs for the film.
Who wrote the lyrics for those?
He did. Oscar Hammerstein had died, and Richard Rodgers was quite a skilled lyricist. And he had, you know, he wrote the score, the music, and the lyrics for No Strings on Broadway after Hammerstein died. And so, you know, they rethought the use of those songs. And really, the stage play is actually a little more political. The songs they cut, there was one called No Way to Stop It, which was really about the political atmosphere, you know, leading to the Anschluss. And and that was, interestingly, another reason why William Wyler, he really wanted to emphasize the politics. And so he wanted the Sound of Music movie to have shots of tanks rumbling around, and, you know, this was not what 20th Century Fox had in mind. And so, you know, it's all a question of emphasis, I think.
Uh-huh. So Mary Martin starred in the original. How old was she when she must have been slightly older than Julie Andrews when she played the role?
Oh, she was definitely older. Mary Martin was actually in her 40s by this point. And so, again, you can do this in the theater because there's the distance of the proscenium arch, but you can't do that on film. And so when they were casting the film, everybody knew Mary Martin was too old. By now, it was 5 years after the show had opened on Broadway. So in the book, I wanted to talk about the other actresses mentioned to play Maria, because those are the kind of fun stories we all like to read about, you know. And so Anne Bancroft, Grace Kelly, Doris Day, these were all names that were bandied about at the time.
Was there anybody really in serious contention? Did they ever test anyone else?
They never tested anybody. I mean, you know, at that point, Grace Kelly was Princess Grace, so she was otherwise occupied. And Doris Day was the biggest movie star in the world, so she certainly wouldn't have tested. But, you know, Doris Day was very smart, and she said, "I'm so all-American, nobody's going to believe me as a nun in Austria." And so people had talked about Julie Andrews, you know, because she was a Broadway star, but Mary Poppins had yet to be released, so they didn't know how she would read on screen. And in the book, I wanted to tell the story about Robert Wise was keen on Julie Andrews, but had never seen her on screen, so he called up Walt Disney, and he said, "I know you shot Mary Poppins, it's not out yet, can I look at a half an hour of footage?" And Walt Disney said, "Sure," and after 5 minutes, Robert Wise turned to his associate producer and said, "Let's go sign her now before anybody else gets her."
And did they get her? Did they get? And 20th Century Fox kind of famous for this. Did they get her cheaply?
Yeah, Julie Andrews made $225,000 for the movie, and she had signed a two-picture deal with Fox. and they wanted her to sign for 4 movies, and she said no. So they signed for, you know, it was just the 2 movies, and the second one was made 3 years later when she did Star, also with Robert Wise. But, you know, imagine when it made Julie Andrews the single biggest movie star in the world, her price shot up by about tenfold overnight.
We're talking with Tom Santopietro, and his latest book is called The Sound of Music Story. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. What was your opinion of the NBC live television version of The Sound of Music with Carrie Underwood?
Well, I brave of her to try it. And I think Carrie Underwood, look, she can, you know, she can really sing, but she's not a trained actress. And so that was, you know, if the plus was her singing, the minus was the acting. And it just made you realize how great Julie Andrews was in the film, because Julie Andrews is a very skilled actress, musical actress. And so, but the material is so inherently appealing that, as you know, that live broadcast was an enormous hit, just tens of millions of viewers. So it just brought the songs to a whole new generation, you know, much the way Lady Gaga did on the Academy Awards.
Yeah, what did you think of Lady Gaga's performance? Were you surprised?
I was really surprised. I mean, my first reaction was she walked out on stage, and I thought to myself, well, at least she's not wearing that dress made of shellacked lamb chops the way she sometimes does. Yeah. But I thought she sounded great. And I, what I liked about it was that there was no irony. There was no wink, nudge, nudge. She, you could tell she had great respect for those songs and was doing them with the utmost sincerity. And what I found fascinating in the aftermath was that the day after the Oscars, nobody was talking about Birdman winning Best Picture. Everybody was talking about Lady Gaga singing The Sound of Music.
Right, right. I think she hit one right, the very last note maybe wasn't so perfect, but she did sing pretty well.
Yeah, right. Not perfect, but she sang really well. And I just thought, oh, this is kind of great, because think of all the young Lady Gaga fans who wouldn't know from The Sound of Music, but now they're exposed to it. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I guess when Julie Andrews sang the song in the film, they had to cover up her tattoos with makeup.
No, <it's... laughs> not Dame Julie. Never, please, no. Don't say that.
Lady Gaga in that gown, the gigantic gown with her tattooed arms hanging out. It was kind of weird, but it's, you know, it's Lady Gaga, right?
Right, and the tattoos were a little distracting with, you know, The Sound of Music, but I just thought I thought she did a really terrific job.
It was a treat. It was. So you mentioned the other actresses. What about the actors who were considered for the role of the captain, eventually played by Christopher Plummer?
Oh, yeah, there was a big kind of a who's who of Hollywood that were considered. Rex Harrison was the first one, Yul Brynner, Sean Connery, who by now is James Bond and a very big deal. And the one that makes me scratch my head the most is Bing Crosby.
You don't think Bing would have played Bing would have played the part?
I think if they thought Doris Day was too all-American, imagine what they would have thought of Bing as an Austrian captain.
I want to see the picture. I want to see the entire movie with Doris Day and Bing Crosby. That'd be great.
And you know, I think Doris Day is the greatest, but, yeah. You know, I, and Christopher Plummer, you know, he was well-known as a stage actor, but not, he had made 3 films, but small roles in them. And Robert Wise had to talk him into doing the role and flew to London to convince Christopher Plummer, because Wise was really smart, and he said that he knew Christopher Plummer would bring a bit of an edge to the captain that the film needed, you know, because it's so sweet-natured. And he, of course, was right, because Plummer brought that dark edge, and, you know, he was disgruntled throughout the filming because he thought the material was beneath him. And but ultimately that helped the film, because the kids in the film, they adored Julie Andrews from the very first day, and they were a little scared of Christopher Plummer, and that helped, you know, because that's what the story is about.
He does seem condescending to the kids, particularly in the scene where they're lying about picking strawberries or something. He definitely has a kind of condescending tone when he speaks to the kids.
Yeah, I think that was kind of on two levels. I think perhaps his reaction to the material, but also I think he felt it was right for the film. And of course, with the passage of decades, he's come to terms with the film, and it's the place of the film in his legacy. And I relate a nice story in the book about he watched it a few years ago at a children's birthday party that he was at, and they were watching The Sound of Music, and so he stood there and watched a good chunk of it, and he wrote about the fact that all of a sudden he felt enormous pride in having been a part of it. So, you know, 50 years later, he's certainly come to terms with it.
And now, one thing they can never do on Broadway is cast an actor who can't sing and dub their voice in with someone who can. But that's right. What they did with Christopher Plummer, right?
Yeah, they did. And he was determined to try to sing it himself. And when you hear Christopher Plummer sing, you can actually, you can listen to those recordings. He's not a bad singer, but it's that, you know, Julie Andrews was so effortless. And so when you hear him in comparison, the discrepancy is too large. And so they had his voice dubbed in with an actor, a singer named Bill Lee, who had dubbed one of the leads in the film of South Pacific as well. Uh-huh. And he did it's very skillfully done, because I think it's hard to see where the lip syncing, you know, is happening. It's pretty smooth, I think.
The guy gets the quality of Christopher Plummer's voice, his speaking voice in it, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And he did a great job. And it's, you know, one of the reasons Robert Wise cast Marnie Nixon in the film, she plays Sister Sophia, is because she had done so, you know, he felt so indebted to her for dubbing Natalie Wood in West Side Story that he wanted her to appear on film for a change.
He also did Deborah Carr in The King and I.
Right, and Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady.
Right.
So, I mean, Marnie is hugely talented.
And now, you met her recently. You interviewed her recently. Is that right?
Yeah, and Marnie is great. She is the nicest lady, and still is teaching voice. And I interviewed her for the book. She was told great stories, and we're going to do a 50th anniversary screening at the Museum of Moving Image, the East Coast branch of the Academy Awards, and I'll interview her at the screening, so I'm looking forward to that very much.
Oh, that sounds great. What do you know the date of that?
Yes, it's Saturday, May 2nd, and the museum is in Queens, New York. And they're going to have a brand new big screen print, so I think it'll be really exciting.
Oh, beautiful. It is really a fine film. It looks beautiful on Blu-ray. The most recent release of it, I think, is pretty great.
It looks terrific on Blu-ray. I agree. You know, it's and I think, you know, when you look at the appeal of The Sound of Music around the world, this wide-based appeal even extends to celebrities. And Gwen Stefani, the rocker, has said repeatedly that it's her favorite movie of all time. We have, of course, Lady Gaga from the Oscars. And then my favorite is President Ronald Reagan. And what I loved and included in the book is the fact that in 1983, the U.S. was hosting the G7 summit, the only time during the Reagan presidency. And so they prepared a briefing book for Reagan, you know, sort of easily digestible format, give him his talking points. And the Jim Baker, the chief of staff, gave him the book. And when Baker went in the next day, he realized that President Reagan had not cracked the book open. He hadn't looked at a page because the book had not been moved. And he said to the president, "Mr. President, you didn't even look at this book." And Ronald Reagan looked at Jim Baker and said, "Jim, how could I have read this book? The Sound of Music was on television last night."
That's a good one. Why is that not so surprising?
Right. I perhaps, depending on one's political persuasion, that anecdote explains a lot. So, what I wanted to do with the book is talk about what, you know, that it's so beautifully made, people forget that. And then tell the stories, you know, the casting stories, but also really look at, you know, the question everybody asks is, why is it so popular? At heart, besides the music and this star and the role she was born to play, I think it's the fact that it's about family, and it's about family as the healing unit, you know, and as the refuge and your sanctuary from the world. And I think that's why the film is universally beloved, because that's a universal emotion. And you said earlier, you know, that I had managed to work in The Godfather.
Yeah.
And, you know, because where they're similar is The Godfather, the first film is also about family, you know, and that it's that sense of the family as your protector in The Godfather. And of course, in the book, I make a wisecrack and say, you know, one of the families solves its problems by singing show tunes and the other one by using machine guns.
Which
but
one is which?
The left.
No, I know the answer to that.
But, you know, I think in the end it's still about family, and that's why people respond to The Sound of Music to this day.
And, of course, the scenery and cinematography is fantastic, but it's also great in The Song of Norway, and that that movie is pretty forgettable.
Oh, really awful. That's the movie you come out humming the scenery. There's no question. It's unwatchable. You know, because there was no compelling story and the music was kind of shoehorned in there. But in The Sound of Music, you know, that Rodgers and Hammerstein were pop culture geniuses. They really were. I don't throw that word around lightly. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they crafted this story that people care about.
And Robert Wise had a long career, which included being the film editor on Citizen Kane. And, of course, Citizen Kane is a movie in which every frame of the film is intentional, so to speak. And I think he carried that idea into many of his films that he directed.
I completely agree with you. And I think he was... there was... Robert Wise could do any job on a film set. You know, he started out as a sound editor on the Astaire Rogers musicals, and then he was the actual, film editor on Citizen Kane, director. You know, there wasn't anything he didn't know. And it's why Martin Scorsese was the one that really pushed for Wise to get the American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award, which he did. Because Scorsese knew this guy is one of the greats we've ever had.
So not an auteur, but I guess just a fine journeyman director who could handle a wide variety of material.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, the auteur school doesn't put him in the pantheon because he doesn't have a recognizable personal style, but I think that's fine. And, you know, it's as you said, he could really range across any genre. You know, he did melodramas, he did women's pictures, he did submarine pictures. He could handle pretty much anything.
Including Star Trek The Motion Sickness, or The Motion Picture. Sorry, I said that wrong. The first Star Trek, which is not a very good film. But you explain in the book that Star Trek, there was some pressure to get the picture done, and he didn't really get the cut he wanted out of it.
That's exactly right. And you're right, it's not a great movie. I mean, there's some really interesting, you know, segments and moments, but it's, you know, slow, and he said that he was under such pressure to deliver the movie for a Christmas release that he didn't get the final cut that he wanted. It wasn't edited the way he wanted, and that's why he always felt it wasn't what the vision he had originally, whereas in a similar genre, he made a terrific movie, I think, of The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really interesting, really good film.
You mentioned another one of his movies that I love with Claire Trevor, Born to Kill.
Born to Kill. Ooh, Claire Trevor, nasty piece of goods in that movie. And you know, that this is what I mean about, you know, that he could handle any genre. And you know, he was a gent, and you know, he and Julie Andrews really did form this lifelong friendship, and which continued until Robert Wise died.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Carrie Underwood was a great singer but not a great actress. But I also know that you know, because of the people you've written about, Doris Day, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, that a truly great singer has to be a great actor in order to put that song across. I mean, that's the difference, isn't it, between Frank Sinatra and Perry Como? I mean, Perry Como was a great singer, but not in the class of Frank.
Right. And you raise a very good point, and I agree with that. They are inherently so dramatic, people like Sinatra or Streisand, that they approach every song as an actor. And I just watched that 4-hour HBO documentary on Sinatra, and you see in the performance footage, he acted out every song. He couldn't help himself. And and Streisand's the same, and Doris Day, in a more understated way, she really could act the heck out of a song, and it's why their work has lasted all this time.
Yeah, so Sinatra's 100th birthday is coming. What you got some special plans for that?
Well, I do this show about Sinatra, which I've been doing for a number of years. We have a great time with this terrific singer pianist named Tony Desserre, who has already headlined at Carnegie Hall with the New York City Pops. And I tell stories and anecdotes about Sinatra, and then Tony sings and plays the great song. So we're doing that in everywhere from Connecticut to Dallas to Florida. So I figure that's our way of celebrating Frank's 100th birthday.
And what are you working on a show on Broadway right now?
Well, I'm actually, because the writing is my focus so much now, what I do is I've created this new job for myself as a substitute, and so I will fill in for could be one day, could be 4 days or a week, wherever somebody needs me. So as we tape this interview this week, I'm going to be doing a couple of shows at The Audience with Helen Mirren, and then I'm going to do a show, this new production of The King and I, at Lincoln Center. And then I think I'll be doing a show at Jersey Boys. So I'm all over the place, which is great, because then it gives me the freedom to still write.
Well, the book is called The Sound of Music Story, How a Beguiling Young Novice, a Handsome Austrian Captain, and 10 Singing Von Trapp Children Inspired the Most Beloved Film of All Time. And the author, my friend Tom Santopietro. Tom, thank you so much for being on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks, Gary, very much for having me on.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. We've been chatting with Tom Santopietro, and his latest book is called The Sound of Music Story, How a Beguiling Young Novice, a Handsome Austrian Captain, and 10 Singing Von Trapp Children Inspired the Most Beloved Film of All Time. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.